And the reason why we're all here tonight?
I'm here.
Why are we here? Okay, well, let's see. From Santa Maria, I'd like to introduce Caitlin to come on up and share her experience, strength, and hope. Come on up.
Hi, my name is Caitlin, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 15th of 2009. My sponsor is Maureen H. from my old home group, Paramount Speakers. My husband and I just moved up here about 6 months ago, and it's been definitely a new chapter in my sobriety, leaving behind all my old friends, all my old support network, being pregnant, being an adult, being in my 30s now. And it's been an experience, and it's an honor and a privilege to speak with you tonight. Thank you, Glenn, for asking me. And welcome to the newcomers. I hope that you hear something that can help you keep going on and just help you get through those rough periods that are bound to come, because, you know, I can't speak for anybody else, but Alcoholics Anonymous has been the best thing that's ever happened to me in my entire life. It didn't always come in the form of, you know, a lot of money or prestige or nice cars or anything like that, but it's the only thing after years and years of struggling with therapists, psychiatrists, well-meaning friends, parents, teachers, boyfriends, people that cared a lot about me. Nobody was ever able to do for me what the people in AA did for me. So I guess I'll just qualify for a little bit. I grew up in Orange County. That's where I just moved from. And I came from a, you know, relatively sane household. There were some slight differences in the way I grew up. And, you know, my dad left when I was, I think, 5 or 6. And he was always in the picture. He was, you know, he was a good weekend dad, as good as you can get, you know, without being there full time. And he was in the program. And when he left, my mom said, you know, I'm done with men. And she got a girlfriend, and they've been going strong for the last 25 years. So, you know, there were some, I was never mistreated as a child, but it was definitely, you know, it was just one more thing that made me feel super different when I was a kid. Why, like, just always nervous that I would have to explain why there were two women accompanying me to back to school night, plus a dad and whatever woman he was married to at that time. I always felt this, like, that I had to explain to other people my background. I always felt less than. It's all the feelings that everybody here seems to have, and that was something that I really felt at home with when I first came to AA. My first meeting was a speaker meeting, and I heard the speaker talk about how for years and years it was just like this constant stress that you didn't even know was there because it's so much a part of your being. You know, like, what do I do with my hands? What do I do, like, in groups of people? What do I say next? How do other people do this thing called life? I never even knew that those thought processes existed inside of my head until I came into AA and I heard other people share about it. And I do believe that, among other things, that that was primarily what drove me to drink, and drink to the extent that I did. So I really tried hard to be, I wanted to be a good kid. I've always had, like, really high ideals and standards for myself and a complete inability to live up to them. And I remember when I got into high school, I was enrolled in, I had tested into all of the honors classes, and I just knew, like, I was gonna, you know, get this GPA, and I was going to get into this school, and everything was going to be perfect, and I would be perfect, and everything would be fine. And I decided that I wanted to be straight edge, because that sounded like a cool thing to do. It was like my first introduction to having a self-righteous elevation over my peers, which was a nice feeling. And I vowed, you know, to never drink alcohol, to never do drugs, anything like that. Well, like, within a couple months of trying to keep up with these honors classes, I realized that they required a lot of work, and I couldn't just skate by on, you know, putting together a paper at the last minute and turning it in and being able to get a decent grade. And so, if, I don't know about you, but if I can't get an A, I'm going to get an F. There's no B, C, or D for me. I'm all or nothing. If I can't do something perfectly, I'm not going to do it at all. And that was what I did when I was 14 years old, my freshman year of high school. And I started hanging out with the other kids that were also getting Fs because it made me feel a little bit better, because at least at one point I was in decent classes. I started seeking lower companionship. And at the time, it didn't seem like that. Like, those friends that I had in high school, the ones that are still alive, we're still friends now to some degree. We don't have a whole lot in common today. But they were, you know, they were the ones that I connected with. They were my people. They were the ones that were there for me when I felt like nobody else understood, and they were my family. And needless to say, they, you know, they did drugs and they drank alcohol. And I had always grown up with stories about how my dad drank. He got sober when my mom was pregnant with me, so I never actually saw him drink. But his side of the family, the few that were still alive, were heavy, heavy alcoholics. And I heard stories from my mom about my dad's drinking. So I grew up knowing that alcohol probably wouldn't mix too well with me. You know, whenever we had Thanksgiving over at my dad's family's house, it was just a wreck. And I liked it. I thought it was funny. Like, it was like a Jerry Springer episode, and people were wasted. The turkey was burnt. Like, the time we get there, there's like already furniture tipped over, and I'd be like, oh, what's going to happen this time? Like, this is going to be cool. But I just knew, like, that wasn't something that I wanted to be a part of. Like, these, yeah, they're my family, but they're losers. I'm not going to be a loser like them. Like, you laugh at these people. You don't, like, you know, you're not friends with them. And so I always decided that I was, you know, going to stay away from alcohol. And that didn't last very long. I decided, you know, with my vow to never touch alcohol, you know, my friends started smoking weed at the time. Because actually it's a lot easier when you're 14 years old and you look like you're 10 to get weed than it is to get alcohol, because the drug dealer doesn't card, you know? And so I started with smoking weed, and eventually I worked my way up to alcohol. And I remember when I took my first drink, I was probably, I don't know, 15. It was that mixture of, you know, you just take a little bit out of each of your friend's parents' bottles and mix it into one bottle so that they don't really notice that there's too much missing out of any one bottle. So that was what we did. And I remember I took a decent sized drink of this wine, schnapps, scotch mixture. Yeah. And I remember it tasted horrible. It burned in it when it went down. But after it hit my stomach, I just felt all that nervousness and all those worries just drop away. It wasn't quite like weed where, like, you know, you get high and then you kind of get more things to worry about. And, like, it was like a spiritual experience the first time I took a drink of alcohol. And I remember my mom was coming home soon. I didn't really know how alcohol worked, but I knew if you consume too much, you would get, like, messy drunk, and I didn't want to get in trouble. So I just took just that one drink, just one. And I remember thinking, if I could just take one drink at regular timed intervals throughout every single day without getting too drunk, I can do anything. Like, I can apply to that job I'm scared to apply for. I can talk to that guy. I can talk to those people. Like, I can do it. Like, I can study for that test that I'm scared I'm gonna fail. I can do it. Like, it was God in a bottle for me. Like, and I remember I went out to breakfast with my dad shortly thereafter, and arrogant as I was, I told him, I was like, hey dad, I had my first drink. And he's like, you know, he's like 15 years sober at this time, and he's like, oh shit, you know? And I was like, but don't worry, it was like so fantastic that I know I can't, like, that I can't keep doing it. So you know, I learned something, Father, that you were not able to learn, and I'm grateful for the lessons that you imparted to me. I will not be an alcoholic like you. I just wanted to let you know that I have had my experience with alcohol. And, you know, I was able to maintain, more or less, for a while. I mean, I'm not really sure what level a 15-year-old needs to maintain at. It wasn't like, you know, I was supporting a family or anything. I kind of just had to show up to most of my classes, not hit my sister, and just, like, not get arrested. Like, I just had to kind of weave throughout that, and as long as I met those qualifications, everything was fine. I wasn't going to get into too much trouble. But things really started to get out of hand when I graduated high school. And I remember I had a plan for when I graduated, because I always have a plan, and they're really good in my head, especially at night when I'm like reviewing them and all the other wonderful things I'm going to do with my life. And my plan was to get, you know, this job at this company, and I would be able to make enough of an hourly wage to work part-time, get my own place, and go to school, and everything was going to work out fine. And I interviewed for the job, and I mean, I was 17 when I graduated. I was young. I didn't have any experience, and I didn't do very well in the interview, and needless to say, I didn't get the job. Now, most people, they would be like, oh, maybe I should, you know, brush up on my interview skills, or, you know, prepare a resume, get some feedback on that. Those are the things I know now. But then I just got this feeling of being a complete and total failure. My plan that I had spent so many hours thinking about and glorifying myself in had fallen through. And honestly, I felt like a loser. I didn't know how to say it at that time. I didn't have the words to say it. But with how emotionally immature I was, and my grandiosity and my hypersensitivity, these were things that I didn't even know existed. I just felt like a complete failure. Like, I couldn't look anybody in the eye and tell them that I didn't get this job, and I just went full force into drinking. And there were a lot of other things that had happened at that time. It wasn't just the job. I had been towing a precarious path for a long time. I had had suicidal thoughts and suicidal ideas. I was 5150'd when I was 16. My parents took me to every single therapist that they could find. I was that kid. I was cutting myself and just carving reminders into my arms instead of using a notepad. And part of it was, you know, me just not knowing what to do with all this anger that I had inside and all this fear. And part of it was I liked the attention. I was building a persona of myself. Like, I was the psycho bitch. And, like, it worked for me, you know? Like, I mean, I was popular. People liked me. I liked me. I thought that I was hilarious. And, you know, and that type of behavior ends you up in a mental hospital. And I was there, and they were like, you know, like the actually crazy people, like the ones that like eat weird things and like, you know, have multiple personalities, and like these were people that were really sick. And I was like, oh, I feel really bad for you. Like, I probably shouldn't have been acting like this for so long. I don't really think I belong here. And I called my mom to be like, hey, whatever you told the doctors, can you like take it back? Because I'm ready to come home. I don't fit in here, Mom. And she was like, no, you're crazy. You're staying. And you know, in there, I had my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't recall exactly what the panel guys spoke about, but I do remember this is what I got from it. He told a story where one day he smoked too much weed and then went into a bar and got into a fight and then got his like head pounded into the ground and his head like turned into the size of a beach ball. And like, okay, super sad, like rough night. But when I'm like 15, I'm like, dude, that didn't happen. Like, weed did not lead to you getting your head kicked in at a bar. Like, I don't know what you do, but that's just not me. So like, there's a bit of a disconnect here. And that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have another introduction for 5 or 6 years after that. And it just went in one ear and out the other, because I wasn't like the people in the hospital. I wasn't like beach ball head. I was fine. I was experimenting, you know? And so when I was 18, I had started to get pretty, I called it recreationally into drugs and drinking. In retrospect, it was anything but recreational. I remember I was taking community college classes, and I had a group project with actual normal college kids, and they were all talking about what they do and how hard it is for them to get up. And I was like, dude, this is all you got to do. I got all these pills. I have uppers and downers, and then I've got a bunch of booze. And if I have trouble sleeping, I take the Seroquel and I drop it in the bottom of a shot glass. That's what you guys got to do. And then pour vodka on top of it until it disintegrates. And then you take that shot and you sleep really well. And they were like, they're all, how do you wake up in the morning? And I was like, get this. I take 2 Adderall and I put it by my alarm clock. And then I set my alarm clock for 5:30 in the morning. And the first time it goes off, I wake up and I take the Adderall, hit snooze. In 10 minutes, when it goes off again, you're ready to go to school, guys. And they were like, they kind of just looked at me and you know, it's one of those things. It's perfectly normal when you plan these things out in your head. But then when you're around normal people and they give you that look, and that was kind of my first indication that maybe this isn't going to work out, you know? But I pushed on and I found a lovely young gentleman when I was 18, who could procure various substances from around the mobile home park that we frequented often. He had what I was looking for in a spouse, and we got married. And we got married when we were 18. And I remember specifically, we had this conversation, dude, do you want to get married? Think how much my parents would freak out. And he was like, I know, right? Okay, let's do it. And then, and the sad thing is, my parents were so supportive of me. They were like, we had our wedding reception at Silky Sullivan's Bar and Grill. I wasn't even old enough to drink there. My dad got off work to come, visit me. We gave everybody 3 days notice to, you know, and to prepare for this wedding. And then my parents, they never put any undue pressure on me. They just wanted the best for me. And they supported me in that marriage, and I'm sure they were all like, dude, that's gonna suck. but, you know, the day after the wedding and reception, me and my new groom moved up to Humboldt County. Because I just really felt all the drinking and the drugs were getting to me in Orange County, and they were keeping me from realizing my full potential. I think a lot about my potential, especially when I'm drinking. And so I moved up to Humboldt because in my head, the only drug in the area is weed, and weed is not a problem for me. Weed helps me be creative. And I'm an artist at heart, so I'll move there. And unfortunately, instead of going to college and, you know, completing my AA at the community college and going on to HSU, I found a liquor store that was 5 minutes away that would sell to me without an ID. I discovered Steel Reserve that you can get wasted on $2. And I had a neighbor that would sell heroin and methamphetamine, and he would deliver them to my door with a remote-controlled helicopter, which I thought was awesome. You would hear the little tap at the door, and you open it up, and the helicopter had hit the door and then fallen down. You're like, oh, ha ha, and you go pick it up, and then, you know, he retrieves it, waves at you in the window, and I was super stoked. I had I thought for me, that was my I have arrived moment. You know, Bill talks about it in Bill's story, and for me, that was I have arrived. I'm living the dream. I'm living out the substance of my memoirs, and this is going to be awesome. However, all of that caught up to me, and you know, I mean, even with all of the, like, the heavy drug use, the heavy psychiatric drug use, because I was still under the care of a doctor when I wanted to be. It was the alcohol that got me, like those Steel Reserves and the Hurricanes and the 99-cent store wine. Like, they shouldn't make that stuff so cheap. It just makes it so easy for idiots to get so drunk so fast. And I started having blackouts. And in the blackouts, you know, I used to just, like, pass out in the bathroom at the party and, like, lock myself in there. And then I'd come out in the morning, and that was, like, the result of my blackout. It wasn't that bad. Like, everybody laughed. I was alive. No hospital visits. Nobody was crying. And it was no big deal, but I had blacked out from day one. But these blackouts, now I was waking up, and my ex-husband, he, you know, would have black eyes and scratches on his face. And, you know, he was not, like, the best choice for husband material, but he was by no means a bad guy. He was not violent. He wasn't mean. He was a very, very kind person. And I remember just waking up and having these flashes of things I had said and done the night before. And I couldn't reconcile that with, like, the person I had thought I was. And I was like, there's no, like, that had to be a nightmare. And I just had this sinking feeling that I knew it wasn't a nightmare. Like, I had treated another human being that way. I remember it scared me because I didn't know why that was happening. And I didn't know why, you know, sometimes I could drink and it would be okay. And then sometimes I would drink and absolutely horrible things would happen. And that went on for a while. And that was, you know, my first introduction to trying to control and enjoy my drinking. You know, my first thing was to stop drinking tequila. And I think I haven't had tequila in like 15 years because I just learned that that was going to be bad really soon. And then I couldn't drink vodka anymore because it was vodka that was the problem. Vodka made me violent. And so I got to this point where the only thing I was drinking was just like a ton of Natty Ice, because that's basically water. That and other types of malt liquor. And that could at least allow me to drink longer before I would black out or do something where somebody was going to call the cops. And that makes you really, really fat. And I've seen pictures of myself from that period of time, and I think I was 19, maybe 20, and I was very overweight. My eyes were sunken. I just looked like a Jerry Springer guest, you know? Like, I looked like my family. And I just couldn't believe, like, how much I was giving away. How much I was giving away to alcohol and to drugs. And I remember thinking, like, it would be cool if I could do this different. I started wanting to do something different when I was, you know, maybe around 19 or 20 years old. Needless to say, that marriage didn't last. We separated and I moved to the desert because I am very good at geographics. And he went back to his parents' house. And I had my first experiences with sobriety when I was out in living in Palm Springs in the Desert Hot Springs area. My sobriety at that time was that I wouldn't do drugs or drink when I was in that zip code. But on like every other weekend or so, I would make the drive down to Orange County and I would party with my friends and just kind of, you know, let a little bit of steam off. And so the most sobriety I had was like just little like snatches of a week at a time, maybe. And that was actually when things got the most terrifying. When my drinking, the amount that I was consuming was the least, that was when I knew that something desperately had to change in my life. I was suicidal all the time. It wasn't just trying to get attention anymore. It was, I couldn't keep a job. And for so long I leaned on like, you know, oh, I lost that job because I was drunk. Like, but whatever, I'm 18. Every 18-year-old's drunk, and that job sucked anyways. And then like, I couldn't hang on to these, like, really menial jobs. I was, you know, always getting written up, always getting in trouble, and I was sober. Like, I just couldn't, like, the anxiety and the wreckage of my past had started to catch up to me. I was still incredibly immature. If I didn't know how to do something, I didn't know it was okay to just ask for help. I would, like, make up some story about how I had to go if I didn't know how to, like, get a, you know, a software program to work, or, like, the cash register or something. I didn't know that it was okay to just ask for help, you know? And it made me look like a really weird person. Like, my bosses, like, they felt bad for me. I never really had a bad attitude. I always, like, I was raised well, and I tried to have respect for my superiors and people that were older than me, and I was doing everything I could to just put in, like, all my moral training and anything good that my parents had imparted to me and everything I knew about, like, what a good person does. I was just trying to do that so that I maybe, like, maybe I just wouldn't end up like, you know, my aunt, or like the way, you know, what I'd heard about my dad. And I thought if I just stopped, you know, drinking and doing drugs that it would be cool. And I was, you know, stone cold sober, and I was losing my mind. I lost that job. It was at Panera Bread. I lost that job, and I just wanted to die. I didn't have a friend in the world. The few friends I had, I made them over, you know, drug deals or over drinks. And, you know, those just, you just feel it, you know, there's no one in the world that cares about you. And I remember I just wanted to die. You know, I don't have this story where I lost everything that was important to me. Like, I started so young that I never got anything that was important to me. And that's not even just material stuff. It was like life lessons, experiences with friends, trusting a friend, you know, strong female relationships. I didn't know that was stuff that I needed, but I had never had any of it. And I'm like trying to transition into adulthood, and all I've known my whole life was hell. And I just didn't know what to do. And I didn't know that God was a thing I could pray to. When I didn't know how to do something and I was out of ideas, that was just the end. Like, I couldn't do anything else. I didn't know what to do. And I remember my heart just started yearning for something better. And I guess God saw that as a prayer, you know, and it makes me really, like, think about just how gracious and loving and forgiving God must be, that, you know, he answered a prayer that I didn't even have the words to form. And I remember I was helping my friend move, and I was doing my best at this time. I was helping my friend move, and we got pulled over, and turns out I was helping my friend move his entire marijuana growing operation. I knew he grew weed, but I didn't know that that's what we were moving at that time. I wouldn't have consented to the search had I known what was in there. But it was in there. And then, you know, like, I got arrested, and for the first time in my life, like, I got stopped. You know, I felt some, like, real repercussions for my actions. And, you know, the police, I was like, okay, maybe, like, it'll be, like, a young male police officer, and they'll be super nice to me, and I'll be, like, really cute. But, like, in retrospect, I was fat, and, like, I got arrested in my bathing suit. And, it wasn't a great sight. And I remember, like, I was in the jail cell it was somewhere up north. It was far from home. And I had left my cell phone at home that day. I didn't have any way to get a hold of anybody. But I was sitting in the cell and just kind of thinking about what I had been doing with my life and maybe how I could do something differently. And, I actually felt really bad. I wasn't like, you know, cops suck, like, nothing like that. I was like, they were actually really nice, and, like, I suck, and, like, and I remember they brought me my food, and, like, I felt like the proper thing for an Orange County girl to do would be to, like, turn her nose up at the food and be like, ew, I can't eat that. But I remember looking at it and be like, I want that burrito. And, like, and I remember I, like, ate it all and I really liked it. And I was like, some people say, like, you know, they end up in jail and they're like, I don't belong here. Like, I was there and I was like, I could get into this. Like, and that scared me. Like, I was like, I could totally fit in here. And, like, you know, I do belong in jail, you know? Like, I like this food. And that was when I was just like, come on, Caitlin. Like, think something else. Like, this can't be good, you know? And so I got out, you know, they got me out on OR, and, you know, I knew that I was treading a precarious line once again, and so I, you know, I was doing the week sobriety thing. I was only, you know, drinking and doing drugs on the weekends, and even then it was in moderation, and I was just doing my best, and, you know, and then, of course, the inevitable happened, like, you know, something horrible happened on a weekend. So now my, you know, weekend only drinking isn't working either. And I'm also, like, I know I have a court date that I have to show up to, and I know I'm going to be on probation. So, like, I can't be getting, even, like, little infractions, I can't be getting in trouble. So I tried the full week sobriety on my own. And it was, like, the saddest, most depressing week of my life. And it wasn't, like, you know, there were no, like, crazy car crashes, pyrotechnics, you know, things blowing up on my, like, that made me hit my bottom. It was when I was stone cold sober. I didn't have anywhere to live. My dad was nice enough to let me stay on his couch while I kind of figured out my next move. I didn't have a friend in the world to call. I hit my 21st birthday, and there was literally no one to hang out with. Like, I just felt like I sucked. And, I didn't have a friend in the world, you know? And all I could think about were all those horrible things that I had said and done to people when I was drinking, and how can I ever apologize for that? How can I ever make up for, like, what I did? You know, and just that constant feeling of regret that makes you not even want to get out of bed in the morning. And I remember I was looking for something to read to take my mind off of what I was thinking, because I always like to escape in books. And like I said, I was at my dad's house, and I reached down to his little, like, Reader's Digest basket, and I found a copy of the 12 and 12. And I was like, why not, you know? I didn't feel like my story fit with my dad's, where I had, like, drank to the point of seizures and tongue chewing and multiple hospitalizations, so I didn't think that I could be an alcoholic. But I knew that alcohol and drugs had been causing a huge, huge problem in my life. And, you know, maybe there was something in the book that would help. And I read step one, and, like, I identified with it. You know, I was like, that's what alcoholism is about, you know? Like, it's about the fact that no matter how many times I stop or how long I stop for, I can't stay stopped. I don't choose when I start drinking again. And if I do drink, I don't get to choose how much I drink anymore. Like, it's not, I don't have a choice in it. That's the alcoholism thing. And it explained the phenomenon of craving and the obsession of the mind. And, like, I got it, you know, and I just ate that whole chapter up. And then I moved on to the second chapter, and it was about God. And I was like, no thanks. And I just dropped it back in the basket. And then, you know, I mean, God reveals himself in his time. And, like, he was working on my heart that whole time. And just any little idea I had, God checked it, just knocked it right off the table. It didn't work. Anything I tried to do, even just simple little things, job applications, you know, all the things that I was still holding on to that I thought, if I can do this, then my life will be better. You know, God just knocked it off the table. And it was just a whole lot of nothing for me. And I remember I had a friend that, you know, we had lockers together from middle school on. We were always good friends. We got into everything together. She introduced me to all the things that got me into so much trouble, but she was a good friend. And I remember she had stopped returning my calls for, like, 6 months, and I was really hurt, and I tried to figure out what was going on, and I'd heard that she had gotten sober. And I thought, like, if she got sober, maybe I could too, like, because she was the only person I knew that, like, really drank just the way I did. And she was young, you know, she was my age, she was 21, and I thought only old people could get sober. And I called her up, and she didn't answer the phone, but I just left a message, and I was like, hey, I'm kind of curious about this, like, AA thing that you've been doing. I don't know, maybe we can go to, like, a meeting or something. And I hung up, and then I made another phone call to my weed dealer, and he also didn't answer, but I left him a message and said, I would like some weed, call me back when you can. And then I just sat there, and it was like my first third step. I didn't know what I was doing, but I was like, universe, whichever phone call comes in first, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing tonight. Like, I don't have anything else to do. And, you know, the dealer never called me back. But she, my friend, who had been sober for 7 months at that point, gave me a call back and said that there was a meeting starting that night. And she would come pick me up, you know? And I'm so glad that she came and picked me. Like, I still had my license. I still had a car. But, like, it was my first experience being swooped up in AA, you know? Like, having my license and having a car and usually having some small job, I was usually the one people would mooch off of and try to get everything from. And just seeing the change in my friend. Like, we used to shoot dope together, like, you know, in her parents' garage. And, like, here she is, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. She has a smile on her face. I haven't seen anything like that in a long time. And she's, like, using her gas and her car to come pick me up and take me to this meeting that I could totally take myself to. Even though, in retrospect, I probably wouldn't have had the balls to get out of my car in the parking lot once I saw all those people. You know, I wouldn't have been able to walk into that first meeting on my own. And that was October 10th of 2009. And I just heard a speaker, and he wasn't a circuit speaker. I've never heard him since. His name was Mundo, and he just told a simple story about how he used to drink, why he wanted to stop, what he did to stop, and what his life was like now. And it was just so simple. He wasn't trying to get anything from me. There was no punchline. He wasn't trying to sell anything. And I just felt this, like, feeling of being at peace, you know? I was like, I felt safe for the first time. I was always just trying to survive out there and, you know, get someone before they got me and just stay on top and, you know, it's what we do. And for the first time, I was, like, in this group of people that just wanted to help me. And, it felt very, very nice. I hadn't had a real friend in years. And really, with the friendships I have, I don't think I'd ever had a real friend my entire life. And that wasn't because the people around me sucked. It was because I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to choose a friend. I didn't know that I was, you know, a valuable creature of God, that I was something that God created, and that I deserve to be treated with respect, and that other people deserve to be treated with respect as well. I'd never had a relationship, and I was just dying of, like, thirst for a relationship with someone, a friend. And I dove in head first. Like, I didn't know that there were some people that came to the meetings and just came for years and didn't do the steps. I didn't know that. Like, I just assumed everybody in there did the steps, and that's what I would do too. And I got a sponsor, and she's still my sponsor to this day. She's been through everything with me, thick and thin. She knows me inside and out. And honestly, she was like the first friend I'd ever had. The friend, you know, where you speak the language of the heart. And, you know, she's like 40 years older than me, and she's just the cutest thing I've ever seen. And we're like two peas in a pod, you know, and I spent that whole first year. I've always been really academic. Like, I prefer to read instead of talk to people. And that actually, it served me pretty well in my first year. God worked out everything absolutely perfectly. I read the first 164 pages as quickly as I could, and I did all the 12 steps to the best of my ability as quickly as I could. And as much as I didn't feel like I was up to the task, I started sponsoring as quickly as I could. Literally, I didn't have a single sponsee that stayed sober until I had around 6 years. I thought I was doing something terribly wrong. But I just spent that first year getting everything there was to possibly get out of the program, going to panels, going to, you know, prisons, institutions, rehabs. Like, my home group just thought I was awesome because I was so young, and they, you know, would take me to all the kids' jails and stuff, and I could totally fit in there. And it just felt cool to, like, I had a purpose in life. I wasn't making a ton of money. I always thought that was, like, how I would get better. I just had a little job at Petco that I stayed at for my first 3 years of sobriety, and I just practiced the principles there. Like, I didn't do anything super amazing. I just, you know, something I don't do is steal. That is no longer a part of my identity now that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just don't steal. I don't take things that aren't mine. I don't steal truth. I don't lie. I don't cheat. I don't say things to other people that I would rather them not say to me. And I try to respect everyone as a child of God, you know, and I go to my minimum of 3 meetings a week. And, you know, God knew exactly what I needed because he gave me a flip phone for that first year and a phone plan that didn't have texting on it. So I couldn't, like, just text people if I was stressed or having a problem. I had to pick up the phone and call them. And for someone like me that's just painfully shy, like, it was amazing. And everybody in the program, like, you know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And then those people in my home group did for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know? Like, they helped me to grow into a young woman. I went to college in this program. I just graduated last semester. And then we moved up here. I got married in this program. He's right there. I've gotten a lot of really good things, and a lot of really hard stuff has happened too. Like, there was a 2-year period, I think between years like 4 and 6, where, you know, my dad died, and I was in a school shooting, and I was a teller at a bank, and I was robbed, and, like, all this happened in a 2-year span. You know, I got married during that time. The most traumatic event of all those was getting married. And, you know, like, it was hard. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? Like, I'm miserable right now. Like, I jump at everything. I've got this PTSD thing going on. Like, I felt like I wasn't useful. I just, you know, I was so depressed. I couldn't even open my eyes sometimes. And, but I didn't have to drink through it. And, you know, if you're coming to AA for an easier life, that's not exactly what you're going to get. You're going to get a meaningful life, you know, a life with purpose. But it hasn't been easy, you know. But it's always been worth it. You know, all of that stuff, that would have happened anyways, whether or not I was drinking. You know, my dad would have died anyways. But Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety taught me to, you know, lean into the program and find strength in my weakness, and, like, lean into the herd when I can't do it on my own. And, you know, that let me stand up and speak at his funeral. And it allowed me to handle all of his affairs when he didn't have, you know, his paperwork ready before he passed away. And it helped me to be of service to my family in a really dark time. But it didn't take away the pain, you know. It didn't take away the grief. It didn't take away the years of recovery that losing a parent involves. But it's always been just fine. You know, God provides exactly what we need if we stick close to him, perform his work well. And God has been very graceful to me and to the people in my life. And I just wouldn't have it any other way. Like, I have an amazing life that I'm super ungrateful for today. and, you know, I like having these, like, chances to, like, share my story because it takes me back to the beginning. It's been a long time since I've had a drink. But, you know, I've had a lot of problems in the last 9 years, and alcohol hasn't been a single one of them. Like, alcohol is just a really small part of my sickness. And, you know, I've gotten to grow up here. And I'm just really grateful for Glenn asking me to come and share my story. I'm grateful for my new friends that I'm making. Thank you all for coming out. It's nice to have a herd anywhere. And I'm just really grateful for AA. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming out and sharing your experience, strength, and hope.